Today we're going to continue our discussion of Christian Spain, but we're going to also fold it back into our discussion of Muslim Spain and then the encounter between those two. And we'll also talk a little bit about the encounter between those two communities and the French Jewish communities at this time. We haven't really touched Ashkenaz at all this year, intentionally so, just because one topic at a time, but that whole piece we haven't really touched on, people like Rashi and the Tosafists and all of that. So there's a world that we haven't touched on in terms of the French Jewish community. Yeah, but then it's sequential. Each community has its own culture, and then it goes all the way through. And then once you've seen both or all the different pieces, then you start to see the interlocking puzzle. So it's really a marvelous thing. So we'll touch on that a little bit today. And also a community that we've mentioned but only touched on as well, which is the community of Provence, southern France. We've mentioned that they had sort of an independent culture that combined some of the aspects of the Spanish Jewish community, other aspects of the French Jewish community, and yet at the same time that their own customs, their own traditions, personalities such as the Meiri, who is fairly well known, although not incredibly widely known, certainly not as widely as someone like Rashi or the Rambam, etc. Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, who lives in southern France around the year 1300, that's when he flourishes. So that community as well of southern France, northern France, and then the Spanish Jewish community, there's some fascinating interaction. And essentially the topic that we're going to be looking at today is tracing some of the larger arc of the narrative of a series of Maimonidean controversies. And that's really the subject for today. The notion of a Maimonidean controversy is one that's familiar to scholars, and yet it's been really hard to tease out the history of this. We know that there were a number of conflagrations, basically fires that broke out in the Jewish community, huge disputes over the Rambam's ideas, over the Rambam's thought, not only during his life, but subsequently as well. And it's just, it's incredibly rich, and it was difficult for historians to tease out what had happened. So what I'm going to give you is sort of the general consensus as to the sort of general lines of the narrative. There seemed to have been a number of flare-ups along the way, certain times when there were these huge communal controversies over the ideas of the Rambam, over the text of the Rambam, or the ramifications of the Rambam's philosophical direction and focus on that content, that material, and educational question. There's still a lot of open questions. There's a lot that remains unanswered and needs to be sort of fleshed out towards the exact history. But hopefully we'll do a fair job in giving sort of the general lines that have achieved a scholarly consensus in terms of essentially what it was that had happened. So I want to look at We're going to look a little bit more closely at two of the phases. There seem to have been as many as four phases in this controversy. So I'll give a quick sort of overview as to what we're talking about, and then we're going to go back over the first one. We're going to do a text that's relevant for the first stage in the controversy, and then we'll take it from there. But first, let's do an outline. So the first stage in the series of Maimonidean controversies clearly takes place during the Rambam's life. That we know, toward the end of the Rambam's time, around the years of, during the last 20-25 years of his life. So if you remember, the Rambam passes in 1204, so we're talking about roughly 1180 to 1204. Essentially, the first controversy dies down with the Rambam's passing, but that's the first piece. And that we're going to circle back to and examine more carefully. And then, not long after he passes, so some 25-30 years afterward, around 1235, we have a controversy that takes place in Provence. So that southern French community, when the Rambam's ideas, his texts, the Mishneh Torah, the Mor Nevuchim.
How does he react with everybody rejecting his ideas?
We'll discuss. We'll see. The Rambam wasn't scared of anyone's shadow. Let's say that.
He was shrinking violet.
No shrinking violet. No shrinking violet, he was not. In a forthright and direct manner. Which doesn't necessarily mean that he says, yes, that's exactly what I was saying, and too bad for you for being, you know, backward barbarians, uncivilized, you know.
No, he had one.
You know, anti-intellectuals or, you know, sort of backward people. He sometimes said, no, you misunderstood me, and he clarified what he said. But he certainly never backed down. So So that was one. So the second piece is in Provence. So again, what we're seeing is that there's a very interesting dynamic in which, on the one hand, obviously, we're before texting and email and all of that, communication, lines of communication are blocked not just by countries, but by physical boundaries, by the mountain range that separated Provence from northern France, and some of the harrowing trips that were necessary to get from Spain into that part of the country. It's probably easier, I think, to travel at that point from Spain to southern France than from northern France to southern France. I believe there's that Pyrenees, that there's a mountain range there. So it's a complicated journey, but letters were sent and there was communication. But it took time and it was complicated, and the back and forth was over much longer periods of time. There wasn't a 24-hour email rule or anything like that they have now in professional circles. But slowly but surely, the idea started to trickle into those other communities, but now the Rambam is gone. And so it's
definitely live in a time that's fast for us also.
It's fast for us.
For me.
Right, no, it's incredibly fast. I'm saying it's very
now.
Right, I'm saying it was very different back then. And so there's sort of, on the one hand, it was very hard for communication to actually penetrate and for the back and forth, but it happened. It was real. It wasn't that these were completely unrelated cultures that were not in communications. Exactly at those points of contact that things became, as they say, Hamish, for lack of a better term. So that was the second. The third sort of flare-up was somewhat later, one that we really don't know very much about. It seems to have been centered in Israel, around northern Israel, like in Akra that we've called it, around the years 1288 to 1290. There seems to be some set of issues that are involved there. There's a Rabbi Isaac of Akra, or Akko, who is a Kabbalist, and so things get interesting in that way. We don't know too much about that episode, so I'm not going to go into it, because it's just shrouded in so much mystery that it's very hard to reconstruct. And again, when we study medieval Jewish history, you know, very often we now know what we know because of the incredible spade work by not only brilliant but incredibly dedicated historians over the course of the last hundreds of years. And even then, we have to recognize that to use primary sources and to reconstruct the story with accuracy, we all know that in historical work that can be really complex. And although this is not ancient history, it's more recent, it's also not modern history. And so, frankly, the materials that we have they limit us in terms of what we can reconstruct accurately. And there's sort of that modesty that knows, you know, in terms of what we can say with comfort and what we should just say, you know what? We don't know. And that's it. It's lost to history. And I think that honesty is sometimes better than kind of making up histories, because those usually are like looking in the mirror. We just see ourselves and tend to impose that on history. So I think that's important to say, but that is a third stage it would appear. And then, just a few short years later, between 1300 and 1306, I mentioned the Me'iri flourishing at that time, and this was probably the biggest one in terms of just the geographic area that it spread over. This is a controversy that engulfed the Jewish communities, not only Provence, but also Christian Spain, the community that we're focused on right now. This is the controversy that included personalities such as the Rashba, Shlomo ben Adar, whom we discussed, who's a student of the Ramban, who's one of the prolific authors that we've mentioned. We mentioned just last time, it included the Me'iri, and so, it brought together Provence, Christian Spain, these different communities. So those are sort of four instances, and what we'll see is we're going to focus on two. We're going to focus on the one during the Rambam's life, a little bit on number two, on the one in Provence in 1230, 1235, and then a little bit more on the second controversy. And we'll see that although you might expect, well, the philosophy, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down to philosophy, it was much more intricate than that, much more nuanced, and there's some really interesting ramifications in terms of where people saw the Rambam's philosophy going, which has some contemporary resonance as well, and I think it's really interesting to tease out. So the first one takes place, again, as we say, during the Rambam's own lifetime, as his ideas begin to spread. In particular, in this case, they're spreading within Spain. Here we have the Rambam who lived at the very end, as we've said, any number of times, of Muslim Spain going into Christian Spain, and you have a critique. And this critique is offered by someone by the name, it's a scholar we have not really mentioned yet, I don't know if he's come up at all, the Ramah. The Rama, not the Rama with an Aleph, different person, because remember the Rama is living at the same time as the writing of the Shulchan Aruch, which is the very end of the medieval period, beginning of the modern period. Rav Moshe Iser, that's a different person, is living in the 16th century in Krakow, and that's much later, that's a very different kind of thing. He's the one who wrote, of course, the glosses to the Shulchan Aruch, not so him.
Which one is this?
So this one is the Rama with the Hey, we should call him Rama. Both after the camp, as well as to differentiate him from the Rama. Although I suspect in
camp,
some circles...
Maybe the camp is after him.
Make a joke.
I know. I didn't like it.
I got it.
Could be. So Rav Meir, the circles that named him Rama probably were not in dialogue with Camp Rama, we suspect. Rav Meir... Okay, Rav Meir Halevi Abulafia is his name. Meir Halevi Abulafia, as you can tell what his years are, he was a younger contemporary, basically, of the Rambam. Toward the end of the Rambam's life, he's just coming into his
Abulafia
own.
Abulafia is from Spain?
What?
Abulafia is Spain?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And we have other Abulafias who are Spanish as well.
No, there's... because Abulafia is a name more from Iraq and Syria.
I wonder if... I don't know, for the in the Jewish community specifically.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if it traveled from as part of the it's part of the expulsion. Definitely Abulafia, definitely not the only member of the Abulafia community from, or the family rather, from Spain at this time. There's an Avram Abulafia who's living around the year 1300, who's a fairly radical Kabbalist. Who we'll touch on God willing next week. And next week, by the way, we do the Rise of Kabbalah. I'm really excited about that. That'd be fun. Zohar and all these things. Cool. That should be fun. So he, there's an Rabbi Avram Abulafia as well, who is, I believe, Spanish, who's a Kabbalist as well. So it's also Spain with that same last name. So maybe it carried over. Maybe that's what it was. Anyhow, so the Rama, as we might expect, someone who's living in a Christian milieu, is not as enamored by philosophy as the Rambam, and you can kind of fill in the general lines here. But there's a very particular issue which is debated, which we've alluded to and mentioned quickly, but haven't elaborated intentionally, which is that the Rama accuses the Rambam, essentially, of having denied the literal understanding of the revival of the dead.
Trias HaMeisim.
He claims that the Rambam said that we will not be literally revived.
Okay.
And that the Rambam understood Tchiyat HaMetim as an allegory, that he took it seriously but not literally, and the notion that we are going to die and not be physically revived at the end of days was, to put it mildly, a complicated position. The Rama heard about this. He reads the Rambam's writings in his Mishneh Torah. In other words, the Mishneh Torah was the other than the first book, Sefer Mada, although this is taken from there, but right, for the most part, Mishneh Torah is the more powerful, widely accepted book. Of course, it's controversial in the sense that the Rambam, as we've discussed, was attempting to supplant the history of halacha and seem to say you don't have to study Gemara anymore or Riff or this or that and just learn me and don't worry about all the disputes and I'm going to conclude the halachic discussion and it's going to end here. So of course it was highly controversial, but it wasn't deemed heretical. It wasn't deemed theologically problematic, right? There wasn't that sort of opprobrium of the Rambam's halachic writing. It was just that it was... it was objectionable on other grounds. And yet, ironically, the Rama's pushback, his rejection, his accusation of heresy, is rooted in the Mishneh Torah, albeit in the first section of the Mishneh Torah, the first Sefer Mada, which is more philosophical in nature. It starts off with an Aristotelian proof of the existence of God, a teleological argument, and then includes a number of other more philosophical aspects than, of course, the continuation of the Mishneh Torah. And yet, at the same time, it's still interesting that the Rambam's heresy came from the Mishneh Torah. But it's from Hilchot Tshuva, it's Perekhet Halacha Bet. And in the laws of Tshuva, the Rambam not only discusses the laws of repentance, as we might accept, there are 10 chapters in the Rambam's Hilchot Tshuva, which is one of the books that appears in Sefer Mada, in this first volume of the 14 of the Mishneh Torah. The Rambam, after discussing the mitzvah of repentance, suggests, or he proposes, he asserts that the notion of repentance is rooted in the principle of free will. That's the beginning of chapter 5, Perakei. So in other words, he segues from a discussion of the mitzvah of repentance proper to its philosophical foundations. And once the Rambam starts to discuss the notion of free will, that of course leads him to a discussion of schar va'onesh. Mm-hmm. Because free will for the Rambam, and for many other thinkers, the Rambam stressed this, is the foundation for a legitimate system of reward and punishment. If we are not subject to free will, then why would it make any sense for our just God to choose to reward us for good deeds and to punish us for misdeeds? So therefore, it must be scharva onesh is essentially a consequence and can only be sensible on the basis of the foundation of free will. So the Rambam begins to discuss the larger issues of scharva onesh, and as part of that he discusses what constitutes karet, what does it mean for one to be cut off from the Jewish community, what's the nature of that punishment, and along with that discussion, he touches on the end of days. He touches on eschatology, Tzviat HaMeitim. So it's in that context, therefore, the Rambam discusses these issues, and the Ramah, reading the Rambam's discussion here, so the Ramah understands the Rambam to be claiming that there will not be a literal Tzviat HaMeitim.
What does the Rambam say?
So we can pull it, pull it off the shelf, and
can we?
So we have time? Grab it right now. Of course we do. Yeah, we're going to look at the response. So
because I'm curious, so, what
happens downstairs?
Like, really, what does it say?
No, I
you want me to get it from the base measures?
No, I don't. I'll pull it up on my laptop. That's if I'm not going downstairs.
New world, go up.
Yeah. So, what the Rambam, I mean, just to give some context. So, the Rambam, for example, also claims that karet, right? So what does it mean if someone's punished by karet? So, the general understanding of karet is that a person, for example, would either A, die young. That's one interpretation. For example, the Yerushalmi says that he died at the age of 50. A second interpretation is that one is cut off from their children, God forbid, right? That their children are going to die young, right? That kind of thing.
Isn't also that you don't have a chelik in Olam Haba?
Not until the Rambam wasn't, right? So the Rambam doesn't quite. Well, yeah, some say you're cut off from Olam Haba, but the Rambam says in a very particular way. The Rambam says, essentially, that Olam Haba equals the immortality of the soul, which is a Platonic notion, essentially. And he suggests that karet means you're going to be cut off in the sense that your soul will not be immortal.
Right.
Meaning those who merit Olam Haba, so then eventually, at the very end of days, their souls without their bodies will live on, will be eternal, which is essentially, right, and it's rooted in this Platonic division between the body on the one hand, the soul on the other, that the body is, in our current life, the receptacle, right, or the kli, exactly, for our souls, but that they are fundamentally separable. This was a subject debate between Plato and Aristotle, and debated all the way down Western philosophy, and we have a lot to say about this discussion.
Every soul is continuing.
So for a period of time, every soul continues. That's absolutely true. We have that in our tradition. The Rambam accepts that as well. The Gemara talks about this. The Ramban that we mentioned in Shaar HaGemul, we mentioned that Nachmanides, the Ramban, has a whole book, Torat HaAdam, and as part of that discusses what will happen at the end of days. And the Ramban also agrees and says that immediately after a person passes, really based on the Gemara and many other sources, the soul hovers close to, right, for the week of Shiva, and then this idea, right, the 12 months, and then eventually somehow, right, ascends or whatever that may mean. So certainly the Rambam accepts that, but the question is at the very end of days, at some future time, so will the soul continue to exist forever? Are these souls, quote unquote, running around, as it were, but not in a physical sense, but in existence, in an abstract kind of way? Or at some point, will they expire? So the Rambam's suggestion is, well, that depends on your degree of closeness to God. The closer you're to God, who is the source of all existence, based on basically a Neoplatonist kind of theory of a sort of the emanations from the divine, where basically God is the source in medieval philosophy in many ways, but in this system, basically you have God is the ultimate immaterial, and then there's sort of a series of emanations that become more and more distanced from God, but ultimately become therefore more physical, but ultimately are rooted in godly existence. So for the Rambam, essentially the closer I am to God, the more likely I am to cling to him, which means since he is the source of life and immortality, so therefore I am more likely to continue to exist, and if I'm more distant, then I'm less likely to exist. For the Rambam, karet is really not so much a punishment, but more a consequence. A person who is distanced from God, and therefore from the eternal source of life, that soul will not continue to exist, and that's what karet means. As opposed to olam haba, those who do merit this are those who are closer to God, will cling to him, the source of life, and therefore will be immortal in this platonic sense of the term.
You could argue even about I'm asking more question than an assumption, that karet would be when the person is alive, because they're living with that disconnect, and that is in essence a karet.
Right.
So that note, because they're...
That could be. It's I think, a good idea. I don't think the Rambam would quite say it that way. I don't think it's the sense you get from him.
It would have to be after death.
Right. Now, the way that we live our lives, though, has... In other words, I think it's... I don't know if he spells that out. The physical encasement somehow ensures... It somehow contains the soul, whatever that means, even if it's a brittle soul, even if it's disengaged.
Got
but
it.
Somehow...
Okay.
Continues in that.
Right, regardless of that.
Regardless. But yes, but what the soul is engaged in this physical lifetime has ramifications for the degree to which it's connected to the source of life.
Yeah, because then there isn't quite this barrier of kind of concept of eternity. Like,
right.
Because then you just...
Mm-hmm. I hear
kind
you.
Of how you're living and then right. What happens after.
So which I think you would agree that it's a...
theme. It's not as though there's something that...
Yeah, but
it's
like...
in the sand that... distinguishes between.
Right, but I think he would still say that there is that.
Because there's a hope and potential of somehow what you're saying that.
Right, again, for him.
That's something that changes.
Right, there's some philosophical point there about the encasement of the soul, but I'm not sure I fully grasp it. Here's the Rambam. This is Perek Achet Halacha Gimel. Depends actually how the Rambam was organized. But here's what upset the Rambam. Here's the rest for the citation. So he says, Ho'olam haba. So the world to come, in bo guf gviya, has no physical body.
Gviya is translated as
A gviya is usually a corpse.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's, right, so there's no physical representation, dead or alive, of a human being. Ela nafshot hatzadikim b'levad. It is only the souls of the righteous alone, below guf, without a body, kimalachi asharei. As the angels, just as the angels are not corporeal, so too the righteous in the world to come. Hol ein bo biyot, because there is no corporeality, therefore ein bo lo achila velo shtia. There's no eating, there's no drinking. Velo devar mikol hadvarim, and nothing from all the matters. Shegufot bnei ha'adam tzrichim lahen ba'olam hazeh. You don't need to eat, you don't need to drink, nothing at all. And the Rambam goes on to cite the proof text. This is what the earlier rabbis or scholars said. Ha'olam haba, ein bo lo achila, velo shtia, velo teshmish. There's no eating, there's no drinking, there are no sexual encounters. Ot tzadikim yoshevin, rather it is the righteous sitting. And it's based on Rosh Hashanah, or brachot, sorry, daf yitzayin. V'atrotehem b'roshehem, and their crowns, whatever that means, are on their head. V'nehenim mizid hashchina. And they benefit, they derive pleasure from the splendor of the Shechina. Okay? So that's the Rambam's description.
Oh, their crown, or whatever Torah they learned, the brighter it is.
Yeah, so the Rambam understands. Right, so the Rambam understands the crown to be metaphorical. That's exactly right. Right, exactly right. 100%. So that's the Rambam's depiction.
That you read.
Gimel.
This is it depends. Actually, it's. The way that the Rambam is broken up. The Rambam himself did not break up his halachot. If you look at the original manuscripts, within each chapter, there were later editors who did that. So it's not... And there were people who redid it also in later printings of the Rambam.
So it's like the Chumash Torah, same thing.
Isn't this it was, quite, you know, same thing? Yeah, the chapters...
Were broken, the chapters were actually done by monks, as I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They were done by... It was
the
Christians, not
just... Prakim were Christian... emendations.
The parashiyot,
sure.
The actual parashiyot. Yeah. I don't mean the parashiyot. Those are our tradition. But right now I'm in the paragraph breaks in the Torah itself, those are much more ancient, and those seem to have been much more organic to our tradition rather than Perekhet Pasukei.
I don't understand. Like if other people out of our religion make sections in our Torah, why do we go by it? Why don't we go by what we think should be?
Well, it's just a convention. In other words, you can come up with another convention, but it's not like the other convention. What we know is that the Parsha and Shavuah have a significant status in our tradition. And those seem to be organic. We know for certain that, as I was mentioning, that the paragraph breaks in the Torah itself are authentic and much more ancient and much more significant. But at some point, we need some practical way to refer to where we should start. I mean, if you went by a parsha break, a paragraph, or the entire parsha, right, it would be impossible to learn Chumash. I'd say, well, everyone open up to Bereshit, you know, Parshias, you know, 109, you know, and find the word Vayomer, you know, where it says, you know, Vayomer. You know, it's just not. So it's a valuable, you know, it's a valuable convention. That's all.
Also,
just practically, I'll come back to it.
The breaks in the Aliyot. The breaks in the Aliyot and the breaks in the Parshiyot are without regard whatsoever to the Prakim. So you will have a parasha that will start in the middle of a perek.
Right.
You'll have an aliyah that'll be in the middle of a perek.
Right.
So the aliyot and
right. So we have an outsourced our tradition. You know,
right.
That's right, exactly.
Right.
By the way, there's one example of where there's a new parsha in the middle of a pasuk.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
hi acharei magifa break, and then it continues. Pasuk.
Emes.
Yeah, true.
Emes lamita.
There's one case.
Just
one.
Which magifa? Where are we?
It's
Breishit, right?
No.
Oh, it's the mug of fine delicious.
Yeah.
Sorry, we'll find another time. Sorry, now I'm taking it. It's not with Aram. No.
It's
with Aram. When you said, yeah?
Your husband should know.
It's not with Aram. Okay.
Well,
that actually makes sense.
Hold
your
Torah.
Your husband should
okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. You guys
right?
have a different Torah. Okay.
Right.
I don't know this particular one, but I imagine that there's one. Okay. See, now look, now you're the one who's off topic. Okay. I'll pull us back.
Oh, that
was a valuable tangent. So
yes,
the. Okay. So the. So now the Rama reads this halacha in the Rama that we just read. So if I were to ask you, right, this Olm Haba, right, which. Seems to be, right? That's eschatology. It's the end of the day. We're talking about the same topic here. This is that period of time. So if you read this halacha in the Rambam, right? So during this time of the Messianic era, the end of the days, right? Will there be physical bodies? The Rambam writes, no. Well, what about Tchias HaMesim?
He's silent. He's describing Olam Haba. He's not talking about Tchias HaMesim. So
correct.
It's a confusing
correct. And
assumption
and
that we just switched from describing what Olam Haba
right.
feels like.
But traditionally, Olam Haba and Tchiyat HaMetim were viewed as interchangeable.
Oh.
And they were discussed together as one.
Right. Okay.
You're right, and that's exactly what the Rambam will say. You're right.
That's
absolutely right. I'm just trying to keep...
My
no, it's fine. I just want to keep some material for the end of this year. So the... it's all good. So the... but the Rama reads this, and I don't. The Rama was not so far. I mean, it's hard to know. We lived so long ago. We don't have, you know, we have a fair amount of material from him, but we don't have so much of that that we can discern his personality necessarily. But I don't know if there's any reason to think he was just some reactionary who just went off. But you read this halacha in light of the fact that Tchiyat HaMetim and Olam Haba are generally conflated. And you ask around, and you send this one a letter, and send that one a letter, and you start wondering. And then you see that there are people who are starting to claim on the basis of their own understanding is not literal. And you say, hold on one second, it's true that a religion may value deed over creed, right? That, you know, the philosophy might not be as central as it is in other faiths, but I mean, people are walking around seeing that Tchiyat HaMetim is just some big, you know, figment of our, you know, our collective metaphorical imaginations, and it has a very profound meaning, but not actually that it's going to happen. Well, that can be viewed as dangerous and troubling. It raises questions about the impact of philosophy on the way that we see the world and whether or not we're being authentic to our own worldview. And once we start there, who knows where it's going to end and all that. So the Rama asks around, and eventually he arrives at the conviction that the Rambam really was perhaps denying. Now, I don't know if he wrote letters to the Rambam. I don't know that he was able to write a letter to Egypt. Remember, the Rambam was living in Egypt toward the end of his life. I don't know if that was feasible. I don't know if you can say, well, he should have done his due diligence before he attacked the guy. Right? It's like as opposed to what everyone does on Facebook nowadays, right? Social media. So it's extremely common before going to the original author. It's so easy to just post something to your friends on Facebook or just put it out there in social media, or you just tweet it, right? So that it's, right, is that very often people skip the basic first step of go to the person and discuss it with them. And if at the end of a conversation you feel that there's no resolution possible and you feel religiously or otherwise compelled that you have no choice but to put this out there,
yeah.
Okay, but, you know, did you take that first step? So as opposed to what's all too common in our world, that people don't take those steps because it's much easier to do something else, right? I don't know if we can be critical of him for not taking that step because I don't know if it was available to him. I just don't know. What we do know is that he wrote letters to others living in other communities at the same time whose membership, whose community members were rumored to start asking questions about this notion of a literal Tchiyat HaMeitim. And in particular, he writes letters to the scholars of Lunil. Chachmei Lunil, living in Provence, living in southern France. So he's, again, he's living in, I believe he's from Toledo. He's living in Toledo, Spain. He's writing to these scholars.
Who is from Toledo?
The Rama is from Toledo, and I believe.
I'm going to Spain in the beginning of July, so I'm asking questions.
Great. Wow. We're going to send. I'm so glad you said that. We're gonna send you some homework.
You should talk to Susan Schwartz.
It's just because my roots are there, and that's like my dream for many, many years.
Okay. Wow. That's amazing. I hope we get a whole account. Keep a diary.
That's a good idea.
Oh, yeah.
Have to, yeah. Okay.
Wow. Are you going to claim citizenship when you go there?
I want to. Yeah, I really want to. Right. I could.
You
I could. I thought of how to prove it, but my name, my maiden name is Azubed, and I'm like, how am I going to prove it? The head of the Jewish community, the organization, mm-hmm. His name is Azubel too, so I don't have to prove so much. And, and as I told you last time, Azubel is Asibel. It's
right.
In the diaspora house, they said it probably might be that we're connected to Yom Tov Asibili, Rabbi.
Right, you mentioned, yeah. Uh-huh,
is the name Isabel?
It's Asibel. There's Z and change, so it's Asibel.
So people have the names Asibel. Is that the same name?
Could be. I don't know. It took us years to figure out what it is. We know that we're from Spain.
Right.
The family is from Spain, but mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. now we know that probably we're from the area of Seville. So that's one place I would go to.
Wow.
My sister probably will claim citizenship way before me because I live in America 25 years and I'm not American yet. Citizen. But.
Got it. Okay. So the Rama gets wind of this, and he starts to craft these letters to the scholars of Lunil. He's very upset. I copied it from, we have it in Hebrew, I don't have it in English, we're going to read it. The Hebrew's not so easy, we'll read it together.
To you with this part.
But it's rewarding, yeah, that's going to be what we're going to look at. Let me just show you, if you turn around for a second, you see the black sefer I have on my desk.
Mm-hmm.
That is the Yad Rama. I'll grab it, pass it around. The Yad Rama is the Rama, Meir Halevi Avalafia's commentary. This one is on Sanhedrin. We have him also on a few other tractates and Shas, but not a ton. This is the most prominent one, tractate Sanhedrin. So it's all the laws of Jewish courts. So he has a running commentary of the Gemara from beginning to end, 110 daf plus on Masechet Sanhedrin, and then and it's very often learned with tractate Sanhedrin because some of the traditional Chachmei Sfarad, such as the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva, for whatever reason, did not publish on Sanhedrin. it wasn't, for whatever reason, seemingly learned as regularly in those yeshivot. So what that means is that when another somewhat less popular but still widely respected Svardic scholar wrote an extensive running commentary on the entire tractate, it's going to be studied. So the Yad Rama, even though we don't have him on too many Masechtot, Sanhedrin in particular is very widely studied. So you'll traditionally study the Mishnayot, the Gemarot, Rashi, Tosfot, the Rambam, and the Yad Rama will be right there at the top of the list. And our students, we have the Sanhedrin is in a rotation, and when our students have studied it, they'll have exposure to this sefer among some of the others. So it's a central part of our tradition. Now, appended to this sefer, because this is the most oft-studied sefer of the Rama, they've appended some of his letters. And it's very fitting, because his letters deal with some of the theological issues that are discussed in the final chapter of Masechet Sanhedrin, which we've mentioned, Perek Chelek, the chapter about Chelek in Olam Haba, about those who have a portion, do not have a portion in the world to come. That's the chapter that discusses Mashiach and all these kinds of questions. And so appended to that, he's got a series of letters on related topics to this commentary. It's in the end of Masechet Sanhedrin. It's the end of there. So that's why this letter is reprinted in the back.
Oh my goodness, the makor for Triat HaMetim, they are the source that they are feeling is being conflicted is where exactly?
Oral tradition primarily.
Yes, but there's different accounts. So I'm just curious, is there like one that's the standard, widely accepted, this is the description, and you cannot veer from that without being a co-fair? You know, like what are we...
All they kind of knew, took for granted, I don't think it was so well developed. They had like a full account that they were taking for granted. I think it was more
just that.
You say it every day. You know, it's in the Rambam's own Yud Gimel Ikarim. Yeah. I mean, right? Yeah. The Rambam seemed to claim to be taking it seriously. Yeah. It's part of our legend, part of our lore. And Gemara talk about it, but I don't think that's it. I don't think it's anything more than just that.
Wow. What do you mean? Okay, thank you. That was very helpful.
Physical Tiyanamitim. I don't think that they had like a whole involved narrative necessarily. It's not that you didn't have these conversations happening, but I'm not sure that your average community member or even rabbi had a very strong sense of this is going to happen and that's going to happen and then he's in the.
So that's what
but it's just
interesting.
We know there's Tiyanamitim. But in a sense, that accents it because, like, that's right, because that's it. All I have to know is this. I don't know. What do I know about all of this? But here's what I know. Olam Haba, right? Some sort of heaven, some sort of hell, some sort of Gehenna. Those are real. Those I know. After that, you know.
The reason I'm asking is were they simply searching for something to poke holes in because there was a desire to take down whatever.
The Ram against the Rambam?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
It was that this specifically to me.
I think they just were horrified by the suggestion. It was just inconceivable and untraditional. Right. Well, yeah, I think anyway, the notion
like today,
of reward and punishment for us is just lost in the way that it was.
Okay, fair enough.
We talk about heaven, heaven is a metaphor for wonderful, fictional accounts.
Right.
It's not tangible in the way that it was. I think Dante.
That's helpful.
I mean, we're in the medieval period.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, I'm going to give you the details, and, right? Okay,
that
and I'll tell
helpful.
You. All right.
Now I remember where we are.
Okay, fine. So here's just a sense of the sort of the what animates the Rama. So he writes, for example, and I want to get to some of the other stages as well. But I'll start. It's so b'inyan tchiyat hametim. So here it is reprinted. So he says b'divrei harambam concerning the words of the Rambam. Everyone has me on the small piece across. Perek chet that stands for mit tshuva, right? Stands for halacha bat. So in regard to the words of the Rambam, the eighth chapter of the laws of repentance in the second halacha. And I'm sorry for all the Rashi Tevot here. We'll work them through. She'achar Tchiyat HaMetim, right? And after the revival of the dead, Shuv Metim. Okay? that there's going to somehow they're going to die again. I'll explain to that in a minute. V'she'in achila u'shtiyah le'olam havan, that there's no eating or drinking in the world to come. So it says ma'arich leva'er, that this is the editor's inserting this. Ma'arich leva'er, he goes on to explain kol seder v'inyan tchiyat hametim ve'olam haba. The Rama elaborates what it is that will happen during the period of the revival of the dead and the world to come. Okay, so that's just sort of by way of introduction, whoever published this added that line in. So now we come to Ketav Rama. So here's the actual text of what the Rama wrote to the scholars of Luniel in that original letter, the first communication. Vayehi bikin ati. Says, and it happened. This is right. You get this sense also of the literary style. Yeah. It's not, they didn't just write tachlis. It's very common, this sort of writing. They didn't just write tachlis oriented letters. You know, I received your letter. Here's what I think. There were introductions, and they were poetic, and they were drawing extensively from Tanakh, and it's flowery, and it's gorgeous, and it brings everything together. And it's pretty humbling, too, frankly. I couldn't write this way. So you have to really be a master of. Right, of our sources, of a certain kind of literary style, and then be able to just weave that together in this way. You don't see this every day.
Michael was explaining to me that whole letters would be simply pasuk after pasuk taken from completely different places.
That's right.
But the whole letter, so that how are you, the weather's fine, we're enjoying the occasion, wish you were here, would be in the context.
It's a montage of
pasuk after pasuk.
That's right.
That, with the assumption that you would know where that pasuk was from, also.
Right.
It's the receiver and the sender. Yeah,
that's right.
It's going to be translating the summons.
It is humbling. Right. Cool. Okay. Vayhibi kinati lamunat chiyat hamitim. So it was when I was jealous. Right, so you get to say, yes, he's very open about his emotions here. Right, I was jealous, right, for the sake of Lamunat Tchiyat HaMitim. By the way, that already...
Here, Kinati is more my zealousness.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not
right.
My jealousy.
No, correct, you're right. I think zealous is an excellent word. That's right. And here it's drawn from, for example, right, you have a number of examples, but one example is Eliyahu Hanavi describes to God that he was jealous when he killed the 400 prophets of Baal. And there are the examples, what this invokes from Tanakh is extremely powerful, right? Or you have, or another example, maybe even closer to home, is Pinchas, right? The Kanaot Kinati, Vitzokham. Okay, so Vayhi b'kinati, I mean, some of the resonances in Tanakh are vivid and are even violent, frankly. There's no violence here at all in this episode, but you get a sense as to the passions that this stirs. Vayhi b'kinati, that munat chiyat hamitim, it happened, right? And it's also Vayhi, which you find biblically all over the place. And by the way, Chazal say, just to give a sense, again, just we can do this on almost every word, but for example, Chazal say that Vayhi always denotes something negative. Right? Okay? And he knows that. Vayehi. I mean, you could just read this word Vayehi. He's telling you a story.
Okay,
Mazel Tov, right? That's how you're...
Yeah, no, that's
but if you know what Chazal said, it's all... There are these right layers
right.
Of
Migdal
meaning.
Migdal
Rut. That's it about Migdal Rut is exactly right. That's exactly where they say it. Very timely. That's right. Vayehi b'kinati lemunat chiyat hamitim, right? So with regard to the faith in the revival of the dead, Asher avda milefanenu, which is a lament. I believe taken also from Eicha, that was lost, okay? That was lost from before us, right? In other words, right, he's lamenting that the faith of Tchiyat HaMeitim is dying before our eyes, okay? V'pi rov anshei zmaneinu. Now maybe this is an exaggeration, but you see what he's concerned about. And it's not just, oh, the Rambam denied it. No, it's infecting the body politic. Right, it's leading to problematic in Novideot. The majority of people of our time believe this. Af kimatzu lahem ata arim mitzurot lehatzil einenu. Even though we have found now these fortified cities, right? That's from, of course, the Meraglim, right? To save our eyes, right? So, in other words, you can flee from this. There are some bastions of faith that remain. But the truth is, if you go to the urban areas, if you go out to the to the communities, most people are losing faith. You can run away from it, but my responsibility is not to turn my eyes and shut them and lock myself in the corner with a few and faithful who remain. But I need I'm a responsible leader for the community. So he uses military imagery, right? Na'arti chitzanai, right? So I awakened my arrows. Chanichei li de ra'ayonai, As this is taken from from Avraham Avinu, when he empties out his household and sends the 318 youth to the battlefield. Okay, Chanichei Yilidei Ra'ayonai. Except it's not my literal children. What's Ra'ayonai? Right, so my ideological children, my students, my Talmidim, right? And I mobilized them, and I said, we've got to go out. We've got to counter these ideas. We've got to tell everyone that Tchir HaMetim is real, it's literal. I mean, this is, we're undermining one of the core principles of Judaism, right? We've got to get these ideas, right? Our ideas also, out there.
Ni'alti chitzni, it's like, I'm going to send an arrow on this, whoever says something against what I think.
Yeah. That's right. He says, I'm going to... Right. Right.
That's reminiscent of Yonatan.
Yeah, it's Yonatan and David is exactly right. Very good.
Nice.
Excellent. L'shlach igeret tochechot, to send a letter of rebuke. Right? Umalvat nivuchot. Right? Right? And that which is hard. Umalvat nivuchot, I think... What? Oh, milot nivuchot, excuse me. Right? And words that are... then our nevachot is like words that are of sharpness, right? Lechachmei luniot, the scholars of luniot, v'chol mivin v'hem v'choze, also biblical, and anyone understands among them, and choze has vision, can see, right? Choze is, of course, also the nevuah of a prophet, right? In other words, was spiritual vision, right? Ahadavar gadol hazeh, with regard to this great matter, which itself is biblical as well. And these are the words of my first letter that was sent to Luniel, with regard to the subject of the revival of the dead. And he continues. Right, so in other words, sorry, when the Ramah published the letter, he added, he clearly appended this first paragraph. It wasn't part of his original letter. Mm. He appended this, and then he says, these, where he's setting them down to print, right? And these are the, this is the first. So he saw fit to put this out there. I mean, this is fighting words. He feels it's necessary, and he's explaining the context. And here it is. That's
not
right.
Just a straw man, really.
Exactly. V'hachayot giviyot, right, to revive these corpses, which of course the Rambam's own language as well. Yoshvei Chevel Yam Hatzlaot, right? Those who dwell in the far reaches of the seas. Goy Kretim Sovlei Emav, right? These cut off people, right? in these far flung Jewish communities who suffer their fears. Omechalei Tanchumav, and they are recipients of words of comfort because they're struggling. Yad Maskilai, the hand or Maskili, the hands of my brightened ones or my enlightened ones, Haita Alai, came upon me, Vatisaini Bimarot, and lifted me with vision. So these are words that are drawn from the prophet, particularly from the Sefer of Yechezkel. Why Yechezkel? Because Yechezkel is the one who was the very famous prophecy of the dry bones that then become lifted, which according to many in rabbinic tradition is a clear allusion to Tzchiyat HaMetim. Not all understand it that way, but it was widely understood, and it's very appropriate here. Upon the wings of the spirit of jealousy or zealousness, as we said, and here it's explicit, he placed me in the valley of the bones, right? So this is, he's putting himself in the place of the Navi Yechezkel, right? The word Chose, right? All these allusions. He said, I have by force, against my will, become a modern day prophet. Right, and I have to share. Right, and remember what prophets did: sharp rebukes. I mean, that's what they did. So he's putting himself not because he feels that he's some, but because he feels that he has a responsibility. The revot atzumot and great. Right, this is again a play on words and great disputes, arguments. Right, so there's clearly right. And so he's playing with that. That's right. Atzumot, right? Great, right? Atzumot. It's clearly a play on words. V'himileyat atzumot. Okay, so he's having a lot of fun with this, which is littered with victims, okay, not physical victims, right, but spiritual victims along the wayside, along the road. But Tomer Elayon, he said to me, or you said to me, God, Ben Adam, which is the word, phrase of Yechezkel, God addresses Yechezkel, Ben Adam, Ben Adam, Ben Adam, all over Yechezkel, and much more so than anywhere else in Tanakh, a few times, but it's the word of the Navi Yechezkel. Hatechiyana ha'atzamot ha'el, it is interesting. Hatechiyana ha'atzamot ha'el, will the bones of God be revived? Israel. They are, right, all the Jewish people. And they say, who's going to cure us from the malady of philosophy? Hope in the redemption of the dead has been lost. These are communities that are suffering anti-Semitism, persecution. But it's more than just that this is important to emphasize too. It's not just that the philosophical principle has been lost. Right? Remember, these are communities that are suffering. They need hope. They need something to believe in. Rama, what are you doing? It's not just heretical if that weren't bad enough, but you're stripping them of their hope, right? You're not giving them a reason for optimism. That's leadership 101 at a time of crisis. The Rambam knew that himself because he wrote the letter to the people of Teman, for example, incredibly uplifting and encouraging. Igeret Hashmad, again, right? Written to the community of Tunisia, again, are incredibly uplifting, and yet the Rambam here, his very philosophy is stripping them of any hope for the future. We have that tikvatenu.
I'm disturbing you. It's after Jesus, so it's like almost like agreeing that Tchiyat HaMitim sort of happened.
No, why?
Because that's what they believe, that he got up.
No, why is he saying that? Because Yechezkel? Chesco is just a vision. It wasn't really the thing.
No. But if we don't believe that the dead would rise back, I don't know. It's something
not sure.
Got into my head.
I'm not sure. Yeah. But I'm not sure. I'm in your head.
Because
she's thinking. You think of the resurrection,
right?
No, that I got. But I don't.
Jesus died and got back. So if that already happened,
people can come back.
So why Jews wouldn't believe that it would happen? It happened before. It cannot happen again. I don't know.
Not sure. I'm not.
Okay, I'll think about it.
Okay, great. No. It's definitely relevant, and when we talk nowadays, you know, in terms of, you know, people get scared when Jews talking about someone from the dead coming back to life, and that
second,
you know,
coming. It's about second coming.
Yeah. But this is the first coming.
They got it from
right. But right. So Jesus got up from the dead. Everybody can believe it, but Jews cannot say that my grandfather will come up from the dead, and it's not normal. Why is that not normal? I mean, I'm waiting for Tchiyat HaMitim to see all the great people.
I think.
Like, why cancel the idea?
If Christians believe.
So why is Christian theology so much more objectionable than Jewish theology?
Right. Yeah,
is that what I understand?
Yeah, okay. I think that's what
which is a good question, but a little bit separate meaning, just because the belief in one resurrection only has been with us throughout.
Right.
So it's a good question, but it's not, you know, it's not on the Rambam or the Rama or the communities. It's just something to think about. It's an important question. But I think it's important to separate that from, you know, sort of the fact that this has generally been the assumption. I just have my eye on the clock. I want to.
Yeah.
We're going to have to circle back to the next stage next time. But I want
messianic resuscitation.
Yeah.
Is completely different.
I know, I'm not comparing it.
We've had other resuscitations from dead. We have Elisha stories. We have interesting stories of people coming back
from
the dead.
Yeah.
And so it's different category than a messianic vision of people rising from grave. You know what I hear?
No, that's how I was afraid.
Sorry.
I'm raising it. It's not that I don't believe Jesus coming back from the dead.
Right, right.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to, because we're limited, it's fine. We're running out of time. It gives a real flavor. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You're encouraged to do so, but let me just give you some quick highlights. So if you jump down to the next paragraph, for example, who has saved him? By the way, you can continue, every line is from another section of Tanakh. It's unbelievable. So he says now, next paragraph, who has saved Hanikra Mishneh Torah? And he says, this is right, what is this? This is the Mishneh Torah. Says, I don't know what to believe. Should I believe the tradition that says the Rambam was a more traditional Jew? Or do I say that no, what I follow is the text, and the Rambam seems to deny it altogether? I'm torn. I'm not sure which one to follow. This is itself a biblical, a Talmudic discussion. That is a big debate. Actually, in Masechet Sanhedrin and Abdallah, there's a big discussion. Let's say there's a letter missing, you know, or we read something differently than it's written in the Torah. Which one is authoritative in regard to matters of halacha? So that's again drawing from that. And then he quotes the Rambam, as we were saying, and then he goes on and on and on. And basically, the thrust is that the Rambam's apparent denial of a literal Tkiyat HaMetim is against everything that we've ever believed. It's against the notion that God gave us the land of Israel so that we would be revived and return to live on that land during a messianic era, during that period of time, and so on and so forth. And then he makes a plea. If you go to the next slide, he makes a plea. His father's name, by the way, I didn't mention, but is Todros, Meir Ben of Todros Halevi. And if you take a look at this, it describes again that the fire, right, and that it consumed him at this time. And he turns to the scholars of Luniel on page 10 on the left, and he says, Rabotai, Chachmei Luniel, at the top left, the next page, Chachmei Luniel, Vachasideha. Your heart should live eternally. Uvirosham.
Interesting.
Okay. The proof for cardiac death, not brain death. Okay. Uvirosham zakein v'nasi. And at their head is a scholar and a prince. Nasi panim. V'hu chohen l'keloyon. He is a priest of God. Again, right? That's just like Malki Tzedek in the story with Avram after the four kings are victorious over the five. Harav Rabbi Yehonatan HaKohen HaGadol. Right? HaKohen HaGadol. So he's addressing the leader of that community, who's known as Rabbeinu Yehonatan of Luniel. One of the great scholars. We have his books now as well. I'm learning Brachot. He has a classic commentary on Brachot. To call them home. So I have that at home. But the Rimi Luniel, the greatest of scholars at the time, clearly a Kohen. He says, you are the Kohen HaGadol Me'achav. Right? You and your friends, says, you are remarkable. In other words, what he says is, right, don't, right, this is not a time for modesty, he says. Right? And if you continue, jump down a little bit, seventh line, after the period, toward the beginning of the line, the Chitom Ru Ishu. And if you're going to say, well, he, the Rambam, he's a great man. The envious shall come over. Right? The Rambam's alive. There's just no one like him. In other words, who are we to dispute the ideas of the Rambam? Gamataki Devrechem Kein Hu. He says that's true. He's a great man. He can't disagree with that. But he says, right?
Mikates.
But yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, exactly right.
Wow. Cherry.
Cherry on a roll.
Oh, yeah.
Look at the big
heel.
I'm having
what?
Kina.
Okay, Kinat Sofrim.
Totally.
Okay, it's going to completely... Right. She, by the way, she's going to have... She has to... All Tanakh now. That's a great story with Rav Lichtenstein, by the way. There's a great story about this where he was in the Rav Shir one time and the Rav asked them for some reference in the Midrash Halacha and no one knew. And the Rav called in Rav Aaron, who was the star student in the Shir, and Rav Aaron didn't know. And he was so upset that he wasn't familiar with the source. He said he's going to learn the whole thing. So he reviewed Tanakh or whatever it was in Midrash Halacha, like all these sources, like a huge, you know, swath of material. And he just said, "That's it." Like, you know, so it was that one moment, and he said, "I'm tackling that," and that was it. So this is inspiring to learn Tanakh. Thank you, Jerry. I mean, it really is. So he says. Where did I go? Okay, Jerry.
Yeah.
No?
Got me there.
Oh, come on.
Okay. That was my Panacha part.
Where is that?
That is... I'm going to embarrass myself. I know exactly where it is in the Gemara. It's in Tehillim.
Okay.
It's in Tehillim. In Tfuna Ve'initzah Neged Hashem.
Okay.
Mizmorah, I forget which Mizmorah offhand. It's cited as the Gemara that talks about by Kavod HaBriot, when you how you balance the tension between observing the halakha and not embarrassing a person. Fascinating discussion. So the Gemara says that if it would lead to a biblical violation there, we'd say that despite the importance of Kavod HaBriot, Kavod Shemayim is greater in Tuna V'Nitza Neged Hashem. And so that, but that's part of that tension. It is. Put it on the list. Anyhow, so then he says, "V'lachin next line, v'lachin maharu lehochicho, and therefore hurry to rebuke him." Right? In other words, don't be afraid that you guys are not qualified. This is your responsibility. There's no one greater than you to do this. You'll say he's the genius of the generation. It's the Rambam they're taking on. It's not, you know, it's not one of us. Right? And if it's true that you're shualim ktanim, right? Chalu karmo. Okay? Yeah? Right? Shimshon? Shoftim? Okay? Okay, and so on and so forth.
Wow.
Okay, right? He says, "Don't hold back," and so on and so forth. And he says, he basically inspires them not to be afraid. and goes on and on. So this goes on for quite some time. The Ramah prints a long exchange of letters back and forth. You can see it. It takes up probably 15 pages in here, so I was not going to go through the whole thing. But you get the flavor.
He was obsessed.
What?
He was obsessed.
Yeah, this is...
Yeah, I mean, this
like
is...
I'm so glad I asked. Is this just dumb? Was he just picking an issue to, you know, get
right.
at? Like, no, please,
right.
maybe this is like an essential core value in a different way than we...
And again, I think it's a mix of theology and the lack of hopefulness, and it's all coming together. And he sees that this is not just one or two people who ask the question. This is now a trend. This is out there. It's gone viral. Everyone, it seems, is questioning Tehillat HaMeitzvah.
And I think his harping on giving people hope was based on the times when the Jews were under siege,
right,
they were persecuted,
absolutely.
They had no hope in Olam HaZeh.
That's right.
And
that's what
they're
saying.
Getting up the next morning.
That's exactly right.
They had to look forward to something beyond this
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely.
And if they didn't have that hope, then it was
what
Yehush.
Reason is there to go
it was
on?
Yehush.
Absolutely.
Absolute despair.
Absolutely. That's why.
I think that's what was motivating.
No,
absolutely.
It even upsets me.
Is a part of
and I live in 2015.
Right. Well, you haven't heard the Rambam's response yet.
That's why I was asking. We have Yechezkel, and then we have this huge oral tradition, which is the only thing that mentions anything about this notion of revival. And then you have this whole oral tradition that.
But
that,
again,
that
ironically, in a sense, it's
to know
a reason.
Where did this even come from?
Right. So that, and that's
because Yechezkel.
Right. Oh, and if it's right. it's the rabbinic tradition. It's the oral law. It's not rooted primarily in.
So that's really helpful.
So we can discuss where, you know, but for the purposes of this discussion, if anything, no, another way that's important, and if anything, it works in the other direction. In other words, the fact that you can't point to it explicitly in a text means it's not just that it doesn't matter. It's almost more than that. It requires us, therefore, to strengthen our commitment to the idea. Because people might question it, and they did.
Because if it's in the Torah Shebichtav, then it's Torah Sinai.
Right, but
right,
more than that. But so Torah Shebichtav. But the point
no,
is,
saying,
we have to...
You have to hold it
of
that
course.
Same way and not...
Same that way, and therefore, and precisely because you don't have explicit references, we have to be all that much more committed to redoubling our efforts to emphasize this value. So it cuts the other way. Okay, but...
Yeah.
Fine, so that's now. The Rambam does not say, I deny it. The Rambam's response, I'm now officially late for class, so let me do this really quick.
With you. Right. We'll walk with you.
No, they're downstairs, they're taking a quiz.
They're
there? Why are they here? I think they should be downstairs. So in a word, what the Rambam says basically is, you've totally misunderstood. I mean, he writes an entire letter called Geret Tehillat HaMeitzvah, and that's where this came from, because he was attacked. Everything but physically violently by the Rambam. And he says, what? No, I'm going
to
come down with them. I'm going to help them. They
don't worry about them. That's his response.
What? It's okay. Give me one more minute. Don't worry about it. Just don't look him in the eye. and what the Rambam says is essentially, you've totally misunderstood. I do not deny a literal Tehillat HaMeitzvah. Here's what I think. I think that there are going to be two stages in the Messianic era. Stage one is Tehillat HaMeitzvah. After we die, the Rambam believes we will be revived. Everyone, or at least everyone who's worthy, a very large percentage, as it were, population, Jews, Gentiles, whatever. And then he says, we're going to actually, interestingly enough, live out our lives again.
Live our life again?
Live again.
Right.
Live a second time.
In a different body, though, right?
No, in our...
The same ones?
At what age? Hopefully a good age. we don't know. And the Rambam says, we will die again. And that first life, that's a physical revival of the dead. That's Tehillat HaMeitzvah. But that's different than Olam Haba. Olam Haba starts after that second death, after we live out our lives, after the period of Tehillat HaMeitzvah. We will die. That's where Olam Haba versus Kari comes in. Those who are clinging to God, Olam Haba, eternal lives, no more bodies, only the soul. Those who are not worthy, die. And that's it. They have kare, i.e., they expire, and that's it. And that's exactly what we're talking about. So says the Rambam, I don't deny literal Tehillat HaMeitzvah. I just hold that Tehillat HaMeitzvah is an earlier stage of the Messianic era. And that's basically the thesis of the Rambam. Okay? All right. So... There's a lot more here.
Yeah, we
I'm
have to go back.
Class.
We have to do. We have. To, can we come
good.
Back and revisit this before we go
sure.
into Kabbalah? I don't know that we can go to Kabbalah until we nail this down.
That's fine, but you might miss an Inquisition or two, which is not so bad. No, we'll make the time.
And then maybe next week we'll talk about what your summer plans are, because I'm sure you're imagining you're running down at some point in this.
What? Yeah.
The